From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, documenting the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. Adrian Cal spent most of the 1980s in the Amazon, and his four-part documentary film series, Decade of Destruction, premieres next week on public TV's Frontline. Also, trumpeter Don Cherry talks about his free jazz and world music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of Schubert's String Quintet in C, performed by Pablo Casals. And Maureen Corrigan laments the high cost of honoring your immigrant relatives at Ellis Island's American Immigrant Wall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iran's spiritual leader said today that any Muslim who died fighting the American forces in the Persian Gulf would die a martyr. The announcement today follows suggestions that Iran may open its border with Iraq, a move that would undermine the United Nations embargo. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The call for a holy war against the United States is not new, but it comes at a time when the U.S. government has expressed plans for a long-term presence in the Gulf. Speaking on Tehran radio, the Ayatollah Khomeini's successor, Ali Khamenei, leveled bitter criticism against the U.S. and said Muslim nations will not let America set up a defense and security system in the region. Tehran continues to condemn the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and are unlikely to fall into the arms of Saddam Hussein. However, the Iranians have called on the states in the region to look to them for protection rather than the U.S. The Iranians have been divided about how to deal with the Gulf crisis. In the past few weeks, the dominant voice has been the Iranian president, Hashemi Rafsanjani, who said Iran would honor the United Nations sanctions against Iraq. Today, the radicals have spoken. In Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
One of the final chapters in World War II history closed today when the four wartime Allied powers signed a treaty granting sovereignty to Germany. Deirdre Berger has more.
The end to wartime occupation rights for the Allies in Germany is in sight. Germany will gain full sovereignty when the treaty signed in Moscow today is ratified by the U.S. Congress and the French, British, and German parliaments. This means formal sovereignty will be delayed several months after East and West Germany unify on October 3rd. Under the treaty, the Soviets pledged to pull their troops out of East Germany by 1994. Germany can join NATO, but NATO troops will not carry out maneuvers on current East German territory. Germany has also pledged that East Germany will remain free of nuclear weapons. Tomorrow, Moscow and Bonn will sign a comprehensive treaty improving bilateral relations between the two countries. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger reporting.
There were more fears expressed today that U.S. commercial banks could be facing a collapse like that which devastated the savings and loan industry. The Congressional Budget Office predicted today that even without a recession, as many as 700 commercial banks will fail over the next 3.5 years. That many failures would drain federal deposit insurance funds by more than $20 billion. Both the Congressional Budget Office and the General Accounting Office have agreed that a recession or the failure of a major commercial bank could force the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's $13 billion bank insurance fund into insolvency. Stock prices posted a modest gain today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points to close at 2,625.74 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been predicted that the Amazon rainforest would disappear within 75 years if the current rate of destruction continues. That could mean global warming and a loss of the plants whose extracts supply us with 25% of our prescription drugs. Adrian Cowell spent most of the 1980s filming the destruction of the Amazon and recording the stories of the people who live in the rainforest, make their living there, or make their living destroying it. His camera crews filmed the Amazon being burned, settled, ranched, farmed, and abandoned. He has footage of armed showdowns between homesteaders and the hired gunmen of ranchers. And Cal has documented the story of Chico Mendez, the rubber tapper and political organizer who was murdered in 1988. You can see Cal's work in a four-part series that premieres next Tuesday on the PBS series Frontline. The series and Cal's companion book are both called Decade of Destruction. Cowell is also the author of two other books about the Amazon. Last year, he won the British Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement for his documentary film work. In Decade of Destruction, Crowell says that, like Chico Mendes, he wouldn't describe himself as an environmentalist. There are no animals and few ecological scenes in his films.
There are many people who make extremely good films about the Amazon, about the ecosystem, about the animals, and about the whole nature of the Amazon. And those films can say what a pity it is to be destroyed, but they cannot explain why it is being destroyed, because the nature, the ecosystem, is passive. It is man that is the active force, and it is man that is destroying it. So what our series is about the political, social, and economic forces that produced the massive destruction of the Amazon during the 1980s. And you can actually see those forces overcome by the end of the decade. At present, our camera team is flying with the helicopters of the forestry police, and they say the fires are greatly down, and a lot of other people are saying the fires are greatly down. I'm flying out to Brazil in a couple of days to interview the Minister of the Environment when we should have the final definitive figures. It does look as though the Brazilian government has changed its policy, and it does look as though it is being successful in reducing the fires. And so you're beginning to see a massive change in the politics of what was happening in the Amazon in the 1980s.
Your series opens with some incredible footage of a fire ravishing part of the rainforest, and there's one particularly interesting image of just a tree being burned in this Holocaust-like flame, and the tree is kind of waving back and forth in the wind of the fire. Can you talk a little bit about that particular fire that you filmed?
Well, we filmed hundreds of fires. That particular one, I think, was fired by Renato. Renato was a colonist who we filmed for a number of years. They moved into this area, cut down the forest. You usually cut it in about May, at the beginning of the dry season, and you leave it to dry for as long as possible. And between August 15th and September the 15th, depending on how the weather is, you fire it. And you hope that as much will burn as possible, because it's very hard work to clear what remains. And Renato planted pretty soon after, towards the end of September, with the first rains coming in. And within 2 or 3 weeks, he realized something was wrong, and within 2 months, they realized that their land was so poor that it was really completely impossible for anything to grow. So what had happened was that the rainforest had been cut down. Some people had spent a lot of time and effort trying to make something out of it. They all got malaria. One of their sons nearly died of malaria, and it was completely useless. And at present, that particular state of Rondônia, 60% of the area that has been cut down is now either scrub going back to forest or the early pioneer forest coming in, i.e. that land, 60% of the land that was cut down has now been abandoned.
You actually spent a lot of time with homesteaders for your documentary series. Why have there been so many landless people in Brazil who've decided to try to settle in the rainforest?
In Brazil, there are 12 million landless poor. That is the government figure. Most of these people originally had land, or their fathers had land, and the process of the mechanization and capitalization of agriculture has forced them off the land. Also, in many cases, extremely violent methods used by the landowners and land speculators who hire gunmen to drive them off. And these things drive the people into the Amazon. The government in the early 1980s regarded the Amazon as a sort of dumping ground for social problems. They didn't want to face the problem which this question of landlessness in the developed part of Brazil caused, so they systematically advocated migration to the Amazon and gave away free land there. Of course, all that did was to transfer the problems that existed in other parts of Brazil to the Amazon, and the Amazon itself became an area of very vicious land feud. I mean, altogether over the 1980s, the Amnesty International figure is well over 1,000 murders as a direct result of land feuds.
It's I think, kind of a confusing situation if you haven't been following it. But you have these homesteaders trying to settle in the Amazon, and then you also have ranchers who are trying to clear the Amazon. So what's the relationship between those ranchers and the homesteaders?
The ranchers, in many cases, came in with massive government incentives. About 75% of the investment in a ranch can come from a big company's taxes given back to it if it invests in the Amazon. The idea is to try and get big companies to go to the Amazon. And they get very large areas of land. It is, of course, quite impossible to cultivate the whole of this area. And so in many cases, a lot of it's left as forest, and in many cases, it is invaded by migrants. And in Brazil, if you can stay on the land, if you are a squatter and you manage to stay on that land and cultivate it for 1 year and 1 day, you have the right to remain with that land permanently. And so this situation produces a lot of direct gun battles between the gunmen paid by the ranchers and by the squatters, who all have shotguns or a type of muzzle-loading sort of musket, really, which you push powder and shot and beeswax down on top of it, and it's reasonably effective.
My guest is Adrian Cowell, and he has a four-part Frontline series and a companion book called Decade of Destruction. It's about the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, and Cowell went on his first Amazon expedition in 1957, and he's also written two other books about the region. In telling the story of the squatters, you tell about how they'd come into the rainforest, burn land to clear it, plant on it, then find out that the soil just wouldn't support the crops. The crops just wouldn't grow, or enough wouldn't grow. But what they would do is abandon that land and move deeper into the forest. And that's something I guess I don't understand. If the forest was failing to provide good crops, why would they keep moving deeper and clearing more forest?
There are two things. If the land is extremely poor, then there's not much point. But there are better patches of land, there's no question. And Renato was the man I mentioned earlier who did abandon his land within 2 years. Within 20 or 30 miles, there was not too unreasonable land. The point is that what the nutrients of the forest are in the trees, not in the soil. So when you cut down the forest and burn it, you are actually putting the nutrients of the trees into that soil. And usually, if the land is more or less okay, you'll get a good crop the first year. You can plant rice. You may be able to get another crop a second year. After that, you more or less have to give it over to grass. And if you want to plant anything else, you have to cut down more forest. So you will get a colonist or a squatter will have a plot, say he has 100 acres. He will probably cut every year another 5 or 10 acres, constantly moving in. So it's just not a type of agriculture that works. And what does, the only way you can make it work is by cutting the trees, so each time you've got a new set of nutrients going into the soil. And those are exhausted or washed out by the rain within 1 or 2 years.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of Americans have the image of the rainforest being encroached on largely by agribusiness and large ranchers, you know, ranchers who own big tracts of land. But it seems that it's not only that, it's also landless peasants looking for a place where they could grow food and live. Do you think it's not easy to say who the villains are in this story?
Relatively easy it is to say. You do have, as you say, there are both ranchers, and those ranchers go there with a deliberate government program of incentives. And those incentives are tax rebates. Any company in the period when this worked could get a 25% return of its taxes every year. And you could, any ranch that you built up could have a total of 75% of its investment coming from these tax rebates. So basically, that was just a handout by the government to the ranchers. In a similar way, the colonists were given free land surveyed by the government, and there were meant to be various forms of programs to help them. And of course, there is no real major deforestation in the Amazon without a road, and who built the roads were the government. And the reason why there's no deforestation without a road is you can walk into the forest, you can even plant your crops, but you can't get it out. So the people who go into the forest in advance are the people who are like the Indians. They just grow enough to eat. Or there were a number of previously Brazilian either rubber tappers or caboclos, who are a type of jungle peasant, who just lived there and who really didn't do any harm to the forest because they just cultivated a small area and was enough to live off, until a road was built. Once a road is built, you get the ranchers, you get the colonists, and you get land speculation coming in on a massive scale. So there's no question that what was going wrong in the Amazon was who was responsible. First of all, was the Brazilian government. It was a deliberate policy, and this policy was financed and assisted by the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank for a long period. So what we are seeing wrong before was a government policy that certainly was not good for the Amazon, and now we are seeing a government policy which wants to look after the Amazon and which wants to change the previous policy.
What were their government incentives to build roads through the Amazon and to settle it?
There are two main reasons. One was it came during the period of military dictatorship. There were 20 years of military dictatorship from about 64 to, I think, 84. The military, like all military, were frightened of invasion, and they have this vast empty space of the Amazon. They were frightened that someone would try and grab it from them. So they had a slogan, can't quite remember it now, but it more or less it means occupy the Amazon to integrate it into Brazil. And that was their plan. It was also the plan of all the economic developers, all the people who associated in the type of economics related to the World Bank, who want to see large areas of unused land being used, and they're being used particularly to produce cash crops. And these are cash crops for export, partly to pay off Brazil's international debt. And it was a system of economic colonialism.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Adrian Kell, and he's completed a four-part series called The Decade of Destruction, about the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. And this is based on footage that he shot throughout the 1980s in the Amazon, and he made his first trip to the Amazon back in 1957. He also has a companion book called The Decade of Destruction. We're after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Adrian Kell, and he has a four-part Frontline series called The Decade of Destruction. You were, I believe, the first person to photograph this group of Indians who have basically tried to remain hidden from Brazilians. And how did you feel about photographing them?
Well, the anthropologists have often argued that these Indians should be left in the jungle on their own, and it is a complete intrusion on their life to deliberately go and make contact with them, which this government expedition did, and you can count the photography as a facet of that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this is true. In an ideal world, they should be left alone. In fact, what we learnt bitterly, or what we saw, was that the government had deliberately left this tribe alone for as long as possible. The father of the head of the Indian Protection Organization in that area. The head was called Apuena Morelis, and his father, 20 years before, had made a deliberate decision not to go into this area, not to contact these Indians, try and leave them as isolated as long as possible. Unfortunately, when this completely uncontrollable process of immigration and development started, they did not know the Indians well enough. They were unable to inoculate them properly. They didn't have sufficient influence on them to explain the problems of disease, flu, measles, and everything like that. And in this case, there's no question that the contact of that tribe had been left too late. If it had been done earlier, the Indians would have had more of a chance of understanding what was coming, of already being inoculated, of understanding the idea of medicines, and therefore the necessity when you get ill to travel to the post to get the medicines. And there's the extremely sad case that one in six of these Indians died. And certainly one of the reasons was that the contact was not early enough. The second reason, of course, was that there was no major government attempt to try and restrain the uncontrolled movement of the frontier into this area.
Do you think that there's any chance of the Indians who live in the rainforest forming any political coalitions to help save it?
Oh, they have. And I know these people well and have sort of watched them and talked to them over the years. And one of the things in my book is about the tremendous difficulty in the area of Xingu of the more than a dozen tribes that were in Xingu who naturally did not have a political organization, forming a political organization which was largely contrary to their traditions, but they formed it to fight in defense of their area, and the Xingu National Park grew out of this. And from the Xingu National Park grew the organization called UNI. It was the inspiration for UNI, and UNI is a national organization for all the Indians in Brazil. And surprisingly, the people in the forest who last formed a political organization to defend their interests were the rubber tappers, Brazilians who lived in the forest, but a Brazilian rubber tapper lives isolated while Indians live in a village. So the rubber tappers had much less tradition of working socially together in groups. And it was Chico Mendes, was one of the people who helped build up the rubber tapper organizations in trades unions. And when those trade unions joined together to try and form a national organization for all the rubber tappers in the Amazon, it was the Indians and UNI helped them. And the Indians and the rubber tappers now have an alliance. It's called the Alliance of the Peoples of the Forest. And so there are political organizations all the time working in defense of these people.
You know Chico Mendes very well. And I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a new book by Alex Shumatov.
Yes, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it yet.
It's called The World is Burning, and he's been a staff writer for The New Yorker. And this is also it's a book about the Chico Mendes murder. And in the book, he describes you as the man who created Mendes, and he describes you as a kingmaker. And I wonder what your reaction is to that.
I feel very sorry that people denigrate Chico like this. And I don't mean that nastily. I'm sure he didn't mean it that way. He was saying it loosely. Chico Mendes was a very major success long before I ever came anywhere near him. He had helped found the union in Brasilea, and he founded the union in Chapuri, and these unions successfully defended the rubber tappers in their campaign against the ranchers. And when I went there, Chico was a political candidate for election and was a very well-established figure. The only thing that I did for him was that when he lost his campaign, and there are reasons for this which go into, it's a bit complicated to go into now, he was extremely depressed, an extremely bad situation. And at that time, Chico was campaigning against a road being financed by the Inter-American Development Bank. And I had just come back from Washington from actually filming environmentalists campaigning against the World Bank. And I said that I thought that the environmentalists in Washington would help him, but because no environmental organization will do anything in another country unless the people of that country and the environmental organization specifically invite them, I said that he would only get support if they wrote a letter or if they sent someone. And this had been discussed a number of times. But when he lost, it suddenly became of much more interest to sort of take him away from his defeat a little bit. And so I did ring up one of these environmental organizations, which said, yes, if Chico would like to come and present his case to the Inter-American Development Bank, they would pay for his fare. So that's how Chico went abroad. I also nominated him for a couple of awards. One was the UNEP Award, the Global 500, and the other was one Better World Society in the United States. And I did this through an organization which I'm part of, which is the Television Trust for the Environment. And that was all. And I nominated him because I could not think of anyone who deserved an award more. I mean, Chico was a fully established man with a complete policy, politics, everything. The only thing that happened that may be slightly different was that he got support and attention from environmental groups after he went to Miami, which he didn't have before.
So you have no problem being a part of the story that you're also covering?
Absolutely not. I mean, Shiku was a friend of mine, and I liked him. I was covering him. The campaign was over. The political campaign was over. I rang up someone and made a contact. That's all. I mean, well, it's not very much, is it? And I hope anyone I film, if they want a contact and I have a contact, I'll make it for them. Yes.
Adrian Cowell is my guest, and he's completed a four-part series for Frontline on public television and a new book, both called The Decade of Destruction, about the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. You've called the 1980s the decade of destruction. What do you expect the big issues will be for the Amazon in the 90s?
Well, what it looks like is this summer, the fires are greatly reduced. And it looks as though through the satellite and through the forestry police, they now have sufficient control to, if not stop the fires, very significantly fine and punish anyone who does burn. So the real question is, what are you going to do with the Amazon? First of all, what are you going to do with the already deforested areas? And the minister, José Lutzenberger, is trying to get a major sort of campaign launched to teach the people in that area how to sustainably use the land that they've got. Then there's the question of what are you going to do with the forest? The forest, I don't think, will survive politically. The forest could survive if it was all made a reserve. But what everyone has learnt in the Amazon is that a reserve is a government-created vacuum, and that just incites people to invade it. So the reserves themselves are not very successful. And it is much better to have areas where there are rubber tappers or Indians whose interest it is to protect that area and make an economic living out of it. To give you an example, one of the ways of using the forest is to create what's called extractive reserves, reserves for rubber tappers like reserves for Indians. José Lutzenberger signed decrees with the rubber tappers 2 or 3 weeks ago for the creation of 50 million acres of extractive reserves. Great problem now is how to make these areas increasingly economic and profitable, how to make them more efficient, how to give a greater income to the people who are already working in them. And that needs a lot of scientific research on the products that could be extracted from the forest. So you've got two sides. What do you do with the forest that's standing? How can you make it as economically valuable as possible so that it will survive? And secondly, what are you going to do with the areas that have been cut down and degraded? And very fortunately, at the Group of Seven meeting in Houston this year in July, the governments of the seven richest countries welcome the new stance that Brazil was taking on the Amazon, and they have promised direct economic and other aid to help try and do something about the Amazon forest, to help try and preserve it.
Will you continue to work in the Amazon?
10 years is enough, you know. I probably will go back sometime, but the series was a decade. Thank goodness it wasn't a century.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you too.
Adrian Cowell, his new four-part series, Decade of Destruction, will premiere on Frontline on public television next Tuesday. The companion book is published by Henry Holt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, two members of the AIDS activist group ACT UP. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to music from Don Cherry's new album, Multiculti. Coming up, the trumpeter tells us about his years with Ornette Coleman and his travels around the world, learning the rhythms of other cultures. In 1952, the great cellist Pablo Casals played and recorded Schubert's string quintet in C in a small French village. Now there's a reissue that classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has waited years to hear. He has a review. And commentator Maureen Corrigan wonders about the huddled masses who can't afford to engrave their family's names on the American immigrant wall at Ellis Island. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iran's spiritual leader has called for a holy war against the U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf area. There are reports that Iran has agreed to give Iraq food and medicine in exchange for money and up to 200,000 barrels of oil a day. More than 400 Americans and Britons who have been stranded in Kuwait were able to leave today. Their Boeing 747 was chartered jointly by the U.S. and Great Britain. Israeli officials say that they have asked the Bush administration to clarify its position on an international peace conference after news reports that the Bush administration may now support the idea. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze has proposed an international peace conference that would consider both the Gulf crisis and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Bush has rejected any linkage which pleased Israel, but seemed to leave the door open about the possibility of an international conference to discuss the future of the Israeli-occupied territories. The Soviet Union has long supported the idea, but Israel is afraid an international conference could impose a solution that Israel won't like. Instead, Israelis say, bilateral relations with individual countries can bring peace and point to the Egypt-Israel peace treaty. The U.S. has always supported Israel's position, but Israeli officials are worried that in exchange for Soviet cooperation in the Gulf crisis, the U.S. may agree to pressure Israel to accept an international conference. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Efforts are underway in the Liberian capital of Monrovia to arrange safe passage for relatives and supporters of former President Samuel Doe, who died earlier this week after being captured by forces under breakaway rebel leader Prince Johnson. The main rebel group, led by Charles Taylor, is reported to be advancing toward the center of the capital. Elizabeth Blunt of the BBC has more.
With President Samuel Doe dead and his army in disarray, Charles Taylor's men have advanced swiftly towards the center of the city and the executive mansion. From the Sprigspane airfield, past the site of Monrovia's main hospital, and the stinking shell of the Lutheran church, still full of the unburied bodies of the several hundred people massacred by government soldiers more than 6 weeks ago. The latest reports say that they've reached the area near City Hall, and people fleeing from there talk of fierce but confused fighting involving all three groups, the remains of the army and both rebel factions. On the other side of the executive mansion, the rebel group which killed the president, Prince Johnson's men, are still in position at the city's main barracks, the Barclay Training Center, but today they've held their fire in deference to a request from President Dauda Jawara that the late president's family and followers should be allowed to leave the mansion.
Elizabeth Blunt of the BBC. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, a talk with trumpeter Don Cherry. CBS Records, which is now owned by Sony, has just dipped into its catalog of classical recordings from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and released an extended selection in its budget-priced Masterworks Portrait Series. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that he's been waiting for years to hear at least one of these recordings again.
Schubert's String Quintet in C is his last masterpiece, his greatest work of chamber music. It was written barely 2 months before he died at the age of 31. Its sumptuous melodies and passionate intensity make it one of the most gratifying pieces of music to play. Schubert himself probably never heard it performed, and now it's as if musicians are playing it for him. The greatest performance I know of the string quintet was recorded at the Prague Festival in 1952. Prades is a little French village near the Spanish border, where after the Spanish Civil War, the great cellist Pablo Casals vowed to remain in self-imposed exile and musical silence until Franco was defeated. Violinist Alexander Schneider suggested that if Casals wouldn't leave Prades, the music world should come to him. Schneider gathered some pretty great musicians, and Casals agreed to participate in a festival. Casals is clearly the spiritual center of this performance. Listen to the calm and delicacy of the heartbreakingly beautiful melody introduced by the two cellos in the first movement. It's actually played a little faster and lighter than you'd expect, less intense, but much more spontaneous. It's Schubert singing quietly to us from beyond the grave, as if he was sure that's what his music would eventually do. Two violinists on this recording are Schneider and Isaac Stern. Milton Kadams is the violist, and the two cellists are Casals and Paul Tortelier. Schubert scored the quintet for one viola and two cellos instead of the more usual other way around. The calm adagio is one of Schubert's most uncanny inspirations. The pizzicato cello, as in a serenade, makes the elegy also a kind of love song. One of the things I love most about this performance is what makes it less than fashionable. This is not a smooth, impeccable blend manufactured in the control booth. It's got the rough edges of a group of friends getting together to play music they love in a room, a chamber of one of their own homes. Listen to this uninhibited passage from the scherzo. The sound quality is that of good but not great 1950s monaural LPs. The digital remastering for the new compact disc doesn't change that quality. The great thing is that it's available again after decades of absence. The Masterworks Portrait Series also includes Casals in the Brahms Sextet, the wonderful Schumann First Trio with Alexander Schneider and Mstislav Horzowski, and in three tremendous Beethoven sonatas with Rudolf Serkin. Casals also played in Schubert's two magnificent trios, and these desperately need to be reissued. Unfortunately, these Masterworks portraits are a limited imported edition. But if they spark enough interest, maybe Sony will return to the CBS vaults and begin to dispense more of these lost treasures.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a reissue of Pablo Casals and Friends playing Schubert's String Quintet in C. This is Fresh Air. Don Cherry was the trumpeter in Ornette Coleman's Free Jazz Revolution. Cherry started performing with the composer and alto saxophonist in 1959. After Coleman later headed in a different musical direction, Cherry helped keep the earlier compositions alive in the ensemble Old and New Dreams. But Cherry has headed in new directions as well. In his travels around the world, he's learned the instruments and rhythms of different cultures and brought them home into his own music. He was playing world music before it was known by that name. Cherry has a new record called Multiculti. This is his composition, Dedication to Thomas Mafumo. Bob Stewart is featured on tuba, Ed Blackwell drums, and Nano Vasconcelos percussion. The title of your new record is Multiculti. Is this a shorthand for multicultural or something?
Yes, I guess you could say that. The only difference is that the spelling of culti is with a K. So it's multiculti.
Well, there's a lot of world music influence on your new record and on a lot of your earlier music as well. How were you first exposed to the music and the instruments of other cultures?
Well, it's just a part of the karma, my karma, the way life has been. You know, being raised, actually born in Oklahoma and raised in Los Angeles and Watts, and where that I've been around many people from different cultures. And my grandmother was a half American Indian, Choctaw Indian, so we always kept that tradition of American Indian songs and certain celebrations that we would have. And being raised in a mixed neighborhood where there's people from different ethnic backgrounds, I got a chance to, be exposed to different cultures and music.
Was it your father who was a bartender at a jazz club? Was it he who introduced you to jazz?
Yes, I mean, we were raised around it. Even before coming in 1940 is when we took Route 66 coming from Oklahoma City to Los Angeles. And before that, my father had a club called the Cherry Blossom in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, you know, a lot of great musicians came from Oklahoma. Oscar Pettiford, a great bass player, and Charlie Christian, one of the great guitar players. So it was just a part of our everyday life, hearing and being around music and the whole feeling of parties.
When you played with the Ornette Coleman Quartet at the Five Spot in 1959, the music you were playing was considered very revolutionary. And some people really loved it, and other people thought it was, you couldn't even call it jazz.
Right.
Would you share one of your memories of what it was like then to be in the middle of all this controversy?
Yes, well, what's interesting about that is that when we came to New York in the winter of 59, everyone came from Leonard Bernstein to Thelonious Monk. And like you say, some people loved it and some people hated it, didn't like it. And there would be arguments and fights, and a lot of different scenes have happened. And I remember one night Charlie Mingus bringing Phineas Newborn. And Phineas Newborn has perfect pitch. You know, you can have relative pitch or perfect pitch, and he had perfect pitch. And Charlie Mingus wanted him to play with us. And there was a piano there, so Charlie Mingus had brought Phineas Newborn to set in with us. And we started the set. And Charlie Mingus set Phineas Newborn in front of the piano. And the whole set, we had played four or five tunes, an hour set. And Phineas just stood up there and looked at the piano while we were playing and didn't play a note. And at the end of the set, Mingus came up on the bandstand while Phineas was sitting there, and he took all his elbows and hands and put all the notes on the piano. Like that. And he said, that's where it is. It's all there.
Is one of the reasons why Ornette Coleman didn't use a piano in the quartet of the 60s, because everybody was playing slightly off-key intentionally, you know, slightly sharp or whatever, and a piano was tuned, and you couldn't get between notes on a piano.
And you're saying, yeah, the tempered, it's a tempered instrument.
Tempered, yeah, exactly, yeah. Thanks.
And actually, this is something else I've learned, and it's funny how certain things you're involved in and you don't really understand, but you feel it's of value, and later on in years you understand. From studying Indian music again, we realized there's 36 notes in an octave in Indian music. And the semitones, the minitones, are called shrutis. And pitch is one particular reason of not using the piano, because of us working with tones and not just notes, and the different ways of tuning. But one of the reasons of not using the piano, I can also see, is the freedom of percentage of improvisation. What I'm saying is that you can improvise and go in more directions by not having a piano. If there is a piano player that has the ear enough to know the voicings and can be able to voice it in a way where that you can hit those in-between tones or voices that would, which I know Thelonious could and Abdul Ibrahim Dalabrand can.
You used to play in unison with Ornette Coleman on the themes. So it would be trumpet and alto saxophone in unison. But it wasn't the kind of like polished simultaneous playing. You both had tones that sounded like cries in a way. Tell me a little bit about how you'd rehearse and what you'd be going for when you would play in unison on the melody.
Yeah, that's interesting, because now he's really working on something called harmonic unison. But at that particular time, we would learn the compositions frontwards and backwards. And he would write a composition, and I would play the melody, and then Ornette would play with me and write a harmony to the melody. And it's funny, in the harmonic concept, it ends up that when that happens, the harmony that he had written or put with the melody that I was playing would end up being the melody. And the melody that I was playing from the beginning would end up being the harmony. So like an example of that is when we would play with Dewey Redman and myself and Ornette, or Dewey Redman's a saxophone player from Texas that is really fantastic. He's one of the few musicians that really knows the harmonic concept. But it was a period when we would play together, and Ornette would write a third part, and I would be playing the melody, then Dewey would be playing maybe the harmony part that Ornette had written from the second voice, and then he would write a third voice, and it would end up where the third voice that he would write would end up being the melody, and the other two parts that we would play would end up being the harmony.
You've traveled around the world playing, and in your travels around the world, you've picked up a lot of instruments from other cultures that you've learned to play and that you've since played on your records and in concert. One of the instruments that you play a lot is the dusunguni. Tell us a little bit about what the instrument is, what culture it came from.
Yes, it's from West Africa, and it's from Mali, and it was made in a village called Bamako, and the people are Bambara. And in Bambara, duzon is a hunter, and guni is guitar. So it's a hunter's guitar from West Africa.
What do you like about the instrument? I mean, it's a trumpeter, it's a string
instrument.
It's
like a harp, a bass, and guitar, and snare drum all in one. And the sound of it is the same way like with the blues. Like I played it once for John Lee Hooker, and he started singing right away. You know, and the first rhythm you learn is like if you play a tonic and a seven. That's the first. You play it with your thumbs. It has six strings, and the strings are nylon fishing strings and a calabas with a goatskin on top.
Your primary instrument is the trumpet, but mostly you play a miniature trumpet called the pocket trumpet. What do you like about this miniature trumpet over the larger sized one?
Well, the first one I had was made in Pakistan, and that was in the 50s before when I first started playing with Ornette. And it's because of me, I'm very thin person and small. And it's read to my nature, and I can hear the instrument instant because of it not being long. And also because, I like playing cornet and trumpet. With the pocket trumpet, you can get the sound of a cornet, you can get the sound of a trumpet and of a flugelhorn all in this. It depends on you, on what sound you can get out of it.
Don Cherry plays pocket trumpet on his new album, Multiculti, which will be out later this month on A&M Records. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what's next in the series on Young People and Prejudice?
Tonight we have a piece, Terry, on non-standard English and the idea that people who don't speak English with a standard American accent may encounter prejudice and how that affects people and young people. We also will be talking about the declaration of holy war against the United States by Iran, saying that American aggression in the Persian Gulf should be viewed as a holy war, this coming from a country we thought was on our side for this occasion. And we'll be looking at those tomatoes from outer space that won the Kansas State Fair.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A restored Ellis Island opened to the public on Monday. Commentator Maureen Corrigan has some thoughts on one aspect of the project.
I got a letter from Lee Iacocca over the weekend. He's the chairman emeritus for the Statue of Liberty / Ellis Island Foundation. Iacocca wanted to invite me to register my immigrant ancestors on something called the American Immigrant Wall of Honor. The foundation was accepting names up until a year ago, but now, Iacocca says the registry has been reopened for American Express cardholders. This wall is going to be part of the newly restored Ellis Island Immigration Museum. Iacocca says that when the wall is completed, it will be the only monument dedicated to the immigrants who helped build this country with their courage, hard work, and sacrifice. Hear, hear. I'm all for monuments to the common man and woman, so I read on. Iacocca told about how his own father left Italy at the age of 12 and arrived at Ellis Island without a penny to his name. Now, 80 years later, his son is the president of Chrysler. I could identify with Iacocca's sense of pride, if not with his family's dramatic success. All four of my grandparents passed through Ellis Island early in this century, but I always thought that my Polish grandmother, Helen Dobusz, was the bravest. She was 17 when she left her family. She had no money, so her passage was paid for by a company that hired immigrants out as sort of indentured servants once they got here. When she arrived in New York, she was supposed to have been met by some distant cousins, but they never showed up. I picture her at the docks, alone and scared, not able to speak a word of English, the whole incomprehensible country stretched out before her. Somehow, she found her way to Yonkers and those no-good cousins. Then, for most of her life, she worked in factories and cleaned offices. I think she deserves a monument. So do the other 12 million immigrants who passed through Ellis Island. I was about to write my grandmother's name on the Wall of Honor entry form when I read page 2 of Iacocca's letter. It seems the Statue of Liberty / Ellis Island Foundation is charging $100 for each immigrant's name it carves on the wall. Now, this isn't a very democratic way to create a monument to ordinary Americans. The wall will honor only those immigrants whose descendants have disposable incomes or good credit ratings. The rest will remain anonymous, huddled masses. I could afford the $100 this month, but I resent having to buy my grandmother's way into a record of the history that she helped make. Imagine asking the relatives of the soldiers who died in Vietnam to pay for inscribing their names on that wall. No, if the American Immigrant Wall of Honor is for real, then all the Ellis Island veterans should be on it, or no one should. Just make it a plain monument. Remember those words on the Statue of Liberty? Send me you're tired, you're hungry, I light my lamp beside the golden door. Well, the inspiring thing to me about Ellis Island is that its door didn't just open to those who could pay the admission price or plunk down their credit cards.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa McCullough. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two members of the group ACT UP discuss the current issues AIDS activists are organizing around. And James Adams examines which countries supplied Iraq with arms and why. He's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Six. That sound passages here on 91 FM, WHYY FM, Philadelphia.